And welcome to the Midday for a Thursday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and Gabriela Montero is here. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Gabriela Montero is going to be performing with the Madison Symphony this weekend, and that would be Friday night at 7:30.
I think so.
I don't know why I can ever remember that.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's 7:30 tomorrow night, and then as long as you know when the time comes.
Yeah.
8 o'clock Saturday night, and then 2:30 Sunday afternoon. It's the Madison Symphony, and on the program will be the most performed work by a living American composer, if I have that right. That's Blue Cathedral by Jennifer Higdon, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, who has also been my guest during this show. Dvorak's Sixth Symphony, and then Gabriela will be playing the Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 1.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But you do a lot of other things other than playing concertos. You're really out and about.
Yes, it's all kind of began to happen in the last few years like that. I've always been a concert pianist, although I did take some breaks when I was younger. But I also have great interest in human rights. I have great interest in speaking on behalf of people who don't have a very loud voice, who don't have the access to the media that I'm fortunate to have. And I also compose, so I'm performer, composer, humanist, etc., mother. I'm pretty busy.
Your mother was American, your father Venezuelan.
Yes.
But
yes.
You spent your earliest years in Venezuela?
I was born in Venezuela, yes. And we left when I was 8 to come to the States because there was a teacher here that they thought would be the best choice for her as an educator, no? For me, so I was here for several years and then left and went back to Venezuela.
You started playing at the age of 7 months?
Yeah, it's pretty, it is kind of bizarre, but it is true, actually. I started playing by ear, the melodies that my mom sang to me at night to put me to sleep, and my parents noticed a couple of months later that I was starting to play out the tunes of these songs, and by the time I was a year and a half, I played all of them, and was improvising as well, and just had a little repertoire of children's lullabies and the Venezuelan national anthem and many others.
when you were 18 months old?
When I was 18 months old, yeah. And there are tapes of this, actually.
I was going to say, if you have recordings of this?
There are about 150 cassette tapes of that time, and I've heard them, and they are pretty bizarre, to say the least, just to hear someone so little reproduce exactly the themes.
This was largely one note at a time. You couldn't have had too big a spread in your hand at that age.
Yeah, it was largely like that, but I was using all my fingers, so it wasn't only with my index finger, but I was actually, I had a sense of how to use my hands, and I had to jump around the keyboard a little because my hands were very small, of course.
Now, music in your family? Is there any reason to believe that you would have, at the age of 7 months, become a pianist?
No music in my family. In fact, I always say to my mom, I'm surprised she didn't atrophy my ears by her singing when I was little. So no music. It's just me, and I like to call it a sort of a neurological glitch of some type, which manifests itself in other areas of my life.
And so you actually, but you had your public debut at what, the age of 5?
Yes, I was 5. The first time I played a recital. And I was 8 when I had my debut with orchestra, playing Haydn, D major concerto.
And the whopping age of 8. But you haven't gotten burned out starting so young?
No, that's an interesting question, actually. I think there is a great danger to that happening to, well, let's say, okay, what are called child prodigies, because of the evident talent at such a young age. I have had moments when I thought that could happen, just because the inspiration of music making and the incredible intensity of it is something that keeps us going, but it's also something that potentially can isolate us from the rest of the world, and it's also something that can be very crushing in a way. All the expectations and the pressures of the career
and
itself.
And being immersed with a lot of other people who are also career driven.
Well, I mean, I don't consider myself to be career driven. I am art, music, and project driven. I like to create interesting musical projects, and I like to give 100% of myself. So in that need to commit myself to such a high degree, there have been times when I felt this is impossible to sustain for a lifetime, especially when you have children. But fortunately, you know, I'm able to get myself out of that and just focus on the music. And if things get a little bit too overwhelming with all my different activities, then I just basically have a glass of wine and go to bed. That's it.
I get back to Venezuela.
I haven't returned in over 2 years, mainly because I am pretty sure that it would not be safe for me to return, given that I am very outspoken against the violence and the corruption that have dominated my country for the last 14 years, especially. You know, I just to give a little reference to how bad things have become in Venezuela, this last year, 2012, there were almost 22,000 murders in a country of 25 million. So I am speaking out because it hurts. I'm speaking out because I have loved ones that are suffering, and I am constantly in touch with people there who communicate to me the desperation that they live in. So I feel that as an artist, I have the obligation to use my voice, not only to speak about myself and what I'm doing, but also to speak about those people that are in desperate need of a voice and somebody to represent them.
So what would you change in Venezuela in government?
Oh my gosh, that's a loaded question. I would like to see Venezuela as a country where human rights are respected, where there is a fair judicial system. I'd like to see Venezuela enjoying of the multi-billionaire amounts of the wealth that Venezuela has. Absolutely. I'd like to see every citizen, not just the people who sympathize with the government, benefiting from that. And I would like to see the people who have been imprisoned without a fair trial, all of them released and given a fair trial. I would like to see my country as a country where you can walk out on the street and not be afraid to be murdered, because that is the truth. You leave your home and you don't know if you will return and see your family again. So I would like my country to be liberated from the corruption and the violence and to become the country that it once was. Not a perfect place, but a country where everybody could be civil and everybody could live together without this kind of hostility and anger that has taken over in the last years. Unfortunately, it's a terrible situation.
As an artist, do you gravitate toward romantic music or any other particular type? I know you have to be as versatile as possible today, but in terms of your inclinations?
I love good music. I love music from the heart, music that is honest, music that can be shocking at times, music that takes you to the emotional and intellectual extremes. I love Bach, but I also love Prokofiev. I love Vaughan Williams. I love Schubert. I love Rachmaninoff. I mean, I love the human expression when it's heightened and when it's direct and when it's as honest as possible.
Well, here's a miniature to give a sense of what Gabriela Montero does. And this is from a, let's see, this is a set of two CDs on
That's
EMI.
That's my first record with EMI, yes.
How many have there been?
I think there have been five.
Five. Okay, yeah. Well, we'll sample a couple of them, beginning with this musical moment by Rachmaninoff. Certainly some power in that particular musical moment by Rachmaninoff. Is it? Are you one of those pianists who find it just as easy to play fast and powerfully like that as you do more lyrically?
Yeah, I think it's all part of what we do. I mean, we have to be very able to do, you know, to approach the repertoire and conquer it and give it life. I've been really discovering, though, the pleasures of the pianissimos, because I've always enjoyed the fortissimos. I love being enveloped by this powerful sound. But now I've really started to appreciate the extreme of that, and I won't become a very meek player, but you know, I like that part as well.
But the more powerful the fortissimi are, let's put it this way, in a more immediate way to pull in an audience.
Not really, you know? That I used to think that, and that I guess that's also why I enjoyed kind of reveling in this huge, powerful sounds. But in fact, if you're in a recital, and let's say, for example, last year I played a lot the Liszt Sonata, and I was playing at Wigmore Hall recital with the Liszt Sonata and some Brahms intermezzi. And I had moments when I played so pianissimo that the audience, you could really hear them not only breathing with you, but also holding their breath. And it was such an incredible way to have their attention and to be able to move them in a very subtle way as well. So I have to say it works for both.
Well, as it should. That's the way it's supposed to. I'm sure Liszt managed to get rapt attention when he played those soft passages.
I'm sure he did,
Well, one thing that you do that I'm not aware of any other soloist, virtuoso doing, especially in a concert setting, is improvisations.
Yeah.
Spur-of-the-moment things. I mean, literally, you will just ask the audience for a theme, and you get this whole kind of chaos of people calling out various things, some of which you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So now, how do you pick one?
It's a really beautiful process, because in the last 12 years that I've really been very openly improvising on stage, where I even do whole halves of my concerts are improvised, the second halves, I've realized that there is such a hunger for the audience to not only connect to the artist, but the artist to connect to them. It's so wonderful when you see the audience having a voice and actually participating in it, and not just being a passive voyeur, you know, where they can actually bring something to the table, which is more, let's say, more profound than just recognition of the artist, just the applause, but something else. So it's wonderful to see them wake up and actually say, oh, you want us to talk to you? You want us to sing? And then I say, yes. So somebody will be brave enough to be the first one to sing a theme, anything at all. And then I play the theme a few times on the piano just to remember it. And then it takes me wherever it has to take me. There are improvisations that are probably 6 or 7 or 8 minutes long. You can call them spontaneous compositions. They happen in the moment. I have no idea what's going to happen. I allow it to happen despite of myself somehow. I just put myself to the side, and music just takes over and creates itself on the spot.
But you're making a distinction between improvisations and theme and variations.
Yes. Theme and variations can be fun, can be funny, but I don't think they have the complexity of actually improvising a work where the theme somehow is imbued in the work, but it's not the whole thing. So sometimes what I'll do is take the theme and then slightly transform it. And you can see and recognize the theme, but it becomes a bigger element than just those 4 or 5 notes that I was given.
Now, is it? It's almost, or at least it could be, a contradiction in terms to, in a sense, to go into a studio and record improvisations. But is that what you do, or are you constantly, redoing, retaking, trying other things, or is this just what you sat down and played?
It's all improvised. The only thing, you know, that I could say, I walk in with my handbag and I have no idea what's going to happen in the recording studio. My producer has a list of themes that we've thought are would be nice to improvise on. And then maybe I'll do 2 or 3 improvisations on one theme, and then we choose the one we like the best. Or maybe it's just one improvisation on one theme. Say, okay, that's the one. So it's composing on the spot, which is incredible fun, and it's always changing.
Well, I was going to say, if you play an improvisation in a studio, no matter how good it is at the time. Do you ever think afterward, now, you know, then I want to play that again sometime. When I do, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, I'd have to write it. I have to transcribe it, and then, which could be done, of course. I have a lot of people asking me to do that. I just don't have the time. But the beauty of improvisation is that it's ephemeral, and it's created in the moment, and then that's it. It dies. Now, with composition, which is something that I'm also doing, it's a similar process, but there I have the luxury of time to actually make decisions and change things if I want.
So you have an entire CD on EMI, Improvisations on Themes by J.S. Bach. So every one of these 12 pieces you just sat down and played, one take, and that was it.
That was it. That's Bach and Beyond. Yes. That was about 6 years ago I recorded that.
And you call this one Air in G. So this is Gabriela Montero, spontaneous one take. There you have it, an improvisation, I would say impromptu, spur of the moment, but recorded by EMI, and it's one of 12 on that CD, which my guest today, Gabriela Montero, calls Improvisations on Themes by J.S. Bach. How about something even more? Well, you mentioned as you heard this, which you don't actually get to do very often, you mentioned that it has a kind of a Venezuelan quality, which it certainly does.
Yeah, it does. That record, Bach and Beyond, has several that are there. You know, they have a Latin flavor. At the time, that was already 6 years ago, I was improvising much more in those kinds of styles. Nowadays, my improvisations are much more core classical. I'll do 7-minute fugues, you know, I'll do pieces that could sound like Shostakovich or Prokofiev. My language has just become more geared to the classical.
You can improvise counterpoint?
Yes.
Wow. Because a lot of people can't even write it. I mean, people who are, you know, music majors and music students.
It's one of the things I love to do the most, and it's one of the most frequent styles that I improvise on stage. Yeah.
Do you think you have a particular affinity for music, say, by Manuel de Falla?
I love de Falla. I love mm-hmm. Spanish music. Absolutely. And there's a dance in that record which is so lively and so picturesque that I played a lot, actually, in the last few years.
From La Vida Breve.
Yeah.
And here we go with this dance from La Vida Breve by Manuel de Falla. Almost hear the taps on the shoes, can't you,
mm-hmm.
in that piece?
Yep.
Spanish dance from La Vida Breve by Manuel de Falla, and I know you have to go pretty soon, Gabriela, but I want to ask you also about playing at the inauguration the last time around. We'll do mm-hmm. all of that and get to the quiz question, too, shortly here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, we'll do it this way. I have one more question for Gabriela before she takes off, and that has to do with playing at the inauguration for Barack Obama 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, you performed with?
Itzhak Perlman, with Yo-Yo Ma and Anthony McGill.
And how did you do that? I mean, this was for a live broadcast?
Yes. We were there 2 days before, enjoying the incredible atmosphere in Washington. John Williams flew in, of course, for the event. And the thing is that the temperatures were so low that day that the instruments, physically, they were impossible to play. They just did not respond. So, of course, everybody knows that we played, but we also played to track, which is absolutely the only way to announce a president without being out of tune and having the violin strings just break and the clarinet not make any sound.
So this is the instrumental equivalent of lip syncing, is what you're saying.
No, because, well, I mean, I always try to point out that we were not the main, you know, feature of this day.
Right.
It was the inaugural moment of this wonderful president. But it wasn't about us proving that we were playing this or not. It was about giving the most beautiful rendition of a piece for him to be inaugurated as he deserved to be. So that was a decision that we made, which was the professional decision, absolutely. And it was an incredible moment.
And did you participate in any of the other inaugural events?
I went to one of the dances and I left because my shoes were killing me after 10 minutes.
Best reason I can think of.
but I was so cold after the inauguration that I was invited to the parade and I just could not imagine being outside a minute longer.
Even in D.C. it happens that way.
Oh my gosh.
20th of January.
It was grueling. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to ask you one more question mm-hmm. about grueling in just mm-hmm. a second. But let me get to this quiz question. First, we'll review yesterday's question, which was, the leaders of this European country are two princes, one of whom is elected.
Are you asking me?
Yeah, you know the answer to that one.
The leaders of these two European countries?
One European country one with European. Two leaders, and both of them are princes, but one of them is elected.
Oh, my
this
gosh.
Is yesterday's question.
I am the worst Trivial Pursuit player in
it's
the world. I'm good
very
at Scrabble, though.
So. Well, we'll talk about that later, uh-huh. too. But this is a place near Barcelona.
Oh my gosh. Oh, I can't believe you're asking me this on air. I'm blank. Completely blank.
That would be Andorra.
Andorra.
You've probably been there, right?
No, I haven't been to Andorra, no.
Okay. Well, that was yesterday's question. I'm not going to ask this one today of you. We'll put it out there as usual. The first commercially successful one of these was devised in Milwaukee in the 1860s and was produced by a manufacturer of sewing machines and guns. What device would that be? The first commercially successful one of these devices was devised in Milwaukee in the 1860s and was produced by a manufacturer of sewing machines and guns. What was that device? I can give you a hint that it has sort of fallen out of use a lot since the 1980s. So that's the approximately the 1980s. And that's the question for today. You can answer it as usual by emailing me at midday@wpr.org, or you can call 1-800-442-7106 between now and a couple minutes before 1 and give your answer to Michelle. You don't have to be first in to win the prize. Now we're going to let you take your leave of us, Gabriella, with, speaking of grueling, a piece of music that certainly could be the Mephisto Waltz of Franz Liszt.
Oh, wow.
How do you approach that? I mean, it's 11 minutes of nonstop.
Well, the Liszt sonata is worse. That's about 39 minutes.
Right. Well, yeah, there is Liszt. It's harder, I'm sure.
This is the little baby. No, it's a piece about love and seduction and the devil and a beautiful woman and gypsies and just dizzying speeds and dizzying music. And it's very enticing. How do you approach it? Well, like anything else, you just take a deep breath and put yourself in it, and that's it, and hope you survive.
And you have said that music is all about the story, haven't you?
Absolutely. It's all about the human stories. It's about what we feel, what we think, who we are, what means something to you. For me, everything's about meaning. I don't do anything that doesn't have some kind of meaning to me, and that's what drives me.
And you'll be driving this weekend with the Madison Symphony, the Beethoven First Piano Concerto, Friday and Saturday nights and Sunday afternoon. Pleasure meeting you, Gabriella.
Likewise, Norman. Thank you.
And here's Gabriella Montero with Liszt's Mephisto Waltz. Mephisto Waltz, Gabriella Montero, the pianist there, and it's 10 minutes before 1. We'll have the results of our quiz question in about 8 or 9 minutes here on WPR.